is clean, but words cut deep. We gotta take a stand and fight hand in hand. Hide behind your lies and your disguise. It starts with you and I to keep the love alive. You gotta sense of dignity. No hate, we gotta act differently. Why wait? Be the positivity. I'll stand up, we hang enough. Change with your sense of dignity. No hate, we gotta act differently. Why wait?
Welcome back, y'all, to the Java with Just Jody show here on the Patriots Helping Patriots Network. Rumble, BBS, you guys know the drill, right? So grab that cup of Java. I got the most incredible guest today, and I'm quite thrilled to be here as fall has begun, you guys. So first, we're going to have a quick word from our sponsor, and I am going to tell you all about my next guest.
In the political and financial markets, there has never been a better time than right now to invest in silver and gold. When governments simply print billions of dollars in paper money in hopes of solving financial shortfalls, you know that it is time to buy and hold assets of true and lasting value. Free information is available to you right now by calling 888-747-3309. Whether you are a new investor or you're interested in preserving the value of your retirement accounts, we make it easy for you to make smart decisions for your financial future. The specialists at Cornerstone are here to serve you, work to satisfy your retirement goals, and communicate with respect. Call us right now at 888-747-3309. That's 888-747-3309. Or visit us online at cornerstoneassetmetals.com. That's cornerstoneassetmetals.com.
All right. Welcome back, y'all. That's right. My next guest is incredible. He is the president and CEO of the Gavel Project, an anti-woke nonprofit legal organization that exists to protect the freedoms of Americans, especially those of women and children. I quite frankly appreciate that myself, right? He is a constitutional expert, a civil rights activist, and an Arizona attorney. Please welcome Mr. Ryan Heath. He's in the house. Let's go get him. Ryan, welcome. Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
Well, I'm jealous that you are actually enjoying fall. It's 112 here today, so everything's fine and dandy besides that.
Oh, that does not make me feel well. That heat just about breaks me. I'm a Michigan gal off the lake, so, you know, we like it a little bit crispy and nippy here.
Yeah, we don't get that crispy and nippy here in Arizona, unfortunately. Not where I'm at.
Well, I'll tell you what. I have been affiliated with the Gavel Project, and I knew who you were, so I was excited that you came across my path and was available to have an interview today. So thank you for carving time out for me. Let's talk about that first, if you don't mind. I really want people to know how the Gavel Project came about and what stemmed it in your state for you, because you're incredible.
Thank you.
A lot of time, effort, and work into building something that has made a difference.
Thanks so much, Jody. Yeah, so I'm a younger attorney. I don't dress like an attorney.
I'm
my own boss, very luckily. I have a 501c3 called the Gavel Project, and I also have a for-profit firm called Heath Law. And we operate in Arizona, Washington, Texas, New Mexico. And we also, for the Gavel Project, have a number of cases out in California. I'm not licensed in California, so we have to hire attorneys out there to help the beneficiaries of the charity. But, you know, this all basically started back in 2021. I was just out of law school in 2020. I graduated during the COVID pandemic and took the bar in a mask and, you know, had all the fun with the COVID lockdowns at that time and the summer of love and all that. So I worked for a firm out of California. I was actually taking over their Arizona office. I have a background in sales. And so I was doing a lot of networking for them, helping to build the business here. And unfortunately, the Phoenix Children's Hospital, this is back in July of 2021, mandated that my sister had to get a COVID-19 vaccine. She was a nurse there at the time. And so in my spare time, working, you know, nights and on weekends, I started drafting correspondence to the board of governors, the board of directors there at Phoenix Children's Hospital, basically telling them that if they didn't give my sister an exemption, I was going to sue them into oblivion. And right. So this is an organization that does well over $500 million a year in revenues. And I was a first year attorney coming out of law school. And I convinced them the day after my sister was supposed to get fired to let her keep her job. And so with that, that vote of confidence, I went to my wife, who was 7 months pregnant with our second daughter at the time. And I told her that I felt that God was calling me to do something and I needed to quit my job and start a nonprofit. And so with her blessing, I was able to do that. And I spent basically the next few months figuring out what it was that the Gavel Project was going to be focusing on, predominantly COVID issues at the time. When 2022 started, I decided to basically empty our family's life savings to fly around the state of California and teach kids and their parents how to civilly disobey their school's COVID-19 mask mandates. And we were setting up lawsuits that were very similar to what Rosa Parks did back in the 1950s with the civil rights era. And so now we have three lawsuits that we're currently funding out in California on behalf of kids that were put in cages, put in closets, stuck outside in the cold. And all these kids were outside for about a month. It's rather disgusting what happened to them. And so we are litigating those cases now out in California. And we've had some great success out there. We've survived multiple motions to dismiss in these cases, and we're keeping them alive. So that's a bit of background on me. I had the unique opportunity in law school my last year to take a class on constitutional interpretation taught by Justice Alito of the United States Supreme Court. So he was actually one of my professors in law school. And I've just been very blessed to understand the Constitution well and just my skill set to help kids and get back as much as I can. I don't get paid from the Gavel Project. All my time is pro bono. And it hurts sometimes to look at all the hours I've put in because that could be money going to my family's pocket, but this is just so important. And that's why I do what I do.
Oh, God bless you. Oh, seriously, you are a real rarity right now in our world. Now I'll say in our community, there's others fighting, but the level that you've achieved already has just exceeded that. I mean, one thing for certain is holding people responsible, the accountability for the COVID-19 was huge, right? And still is. And without people like you in our corner, I mean, where are we going to go with this?
There are quite a few attorneys out there doing, God's work and actually trying to hold these folks accountable. I know that Warner Mendenhall is another great attorney out of Ohio. It's been fighting all over the country. I know Mike Yoder is a friend of mine as well. He's been fighting these issues. And I mean, there are a number of us, but we're far and few between in the legal field that are actually willing to take a stand on these particular types of issues.
Yeah, we got the, mainstream media, the not wanting to jump in and actually, put you out there. Now, I did get a chance to find you on Fox, which was amazing because that was, mainstream exposure that we're not seeing other networks do. And I'm not a Fox lover because of the other things they don't do, but that kind of that, they pointed up after that. I was like, yeah, they're getting some points for me now. Let's go, Fox, because you're actually jumping in and covering something that is true to heart right now that needs to be handled. And it's going to take somebody who has the knowledge that you have and the license that you have to be able to go next level. Right. And
right.
Your other attorneys that are doing it as well. So I was really happy about that. So anyhow, let's get into the Carrie Lake trial. I want to hear everything because I was fighting from afar and that's when I learned about the Gavel Project, right? I'm like, who is this Ryan Heath? Tell me more. And
That's a really interesting situation. So I basically got into election litigation at the beginning of, or I guess the end of 2020. So I was hired by True the Vote to help State Senator Sonny Borelli file a lawsuit up in Mojave County. I was basically, you know, running on fumes with respect to the Gavel Project. I don't take a paycheck. I think I mentioned that. So it was time basically for me to do something different. So I started Heath Law PLLC. And I took on this case for State Senator Borelli, excuse me. And we had a lawsuit that we filed up in Mojave County. And the issue was on signature verification. So in Arizona, when you have a mail-in ballot or if you vote early in person at a voting center, you have to fill out what's called an early affidavit form. It's an envelope that you actually sign under penalty of perjury, saying that you are the voter in question. You are, you know, registered to vote and this is your ballot and you're casting it. And when you have these ballots come in, these mail-in ballots, the county, every county across the state of Arizona is supposed to conduct signature verification. And so there is a statute on the books that says, this is ARS 16550A, and it says, upon receipt of the early ballot affidavit, the county recorder or the other officer in charge shall compare the signature thereon against the signature of the elector from the voter's registration record. That registration record is a term of art. And that means a document that you sign when you are registering or re-registering to vote. And so we at the time back in November, December of 2022 had filed this lawsuit and decided to voluntarily dismiss the case because Kerry Lake's attorneys had filed a very similar claim in Maricopa County, claiming that Maricopa County failed to conduct signature verification in accordance with that statute. And very unfortunately, her attorneys failed to find a case out of Yuma, Arizona from 1997. This is binding precedent in Division I of the Arizona Court of Appeals that overturned a supervisor's election a year after the fact because the county recorder in that instance did not conduct signature verification in accordance with that statute. And so basically the court held that when this statute is violated, it requires the nullification of the entire election from that jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. So the person who had been elected unlawfully was forced to step down. And unfortunately, Kerry Lake's attorneys did not find this case. So her signature verification claim was dismissed. And we, you know, had already dismissed our lawsuit. So I was kind of stuck in the mud with, you know, looking around trying to figure out what to do. And so I decided to take up the mantle as a citizen, as a civil rights activist in affiliation with the Gavel Project. And I actually sued Kerry Lake's judge in the Supreme Court of Arizona. And I sued him for what's called a writ of mandate. And a writ of mandate is a request for the court to issue an order to a government official like a judge to do their job. That's the essence of it. And I basically asked the court, I said, look, there's this binding precedent. No one brought it to the judge's attention. Instead of going through the, you know, lengthy appeals process, why don't we just order Judge Thompson to reconsider the case, consider this new, you know, the lawsuit based on this case law that was missed and move the trial forward on the signature verification issue. And instead of getting sanctioned, instead of getting disbarred for filing a lawsuit against the judge, I actually was asked by the Supreme Court of Arizona to intervene in Kerry Lake's case as what's called an amicus curiae. And an amicus curiae is a third party who's not, you know, in the case as a plaintiff or a defendant, but has a unique perspective to add to the litigation, some sort of, you know, person who just says, hey, look, this is the way the court should handle the case. Here's a different theory, perhaps. That's the sort of thing that an amicus curiae does. Okay. And around that time, I was found by one of my current clients, David Mast, who's a very wealthy individual from Maricopa County. He saw that I had sued Judge Thompson and that I had, you know, put forth a very colorable claim, and he hired me. And so I actually was his attorney as amicus curiae to in the Supreme Court of Arizona in Kerry Lake's case. So I wasn't her attorney. I was his attorney. Wow. And I ended up winning that case in the Supreme Court. So, you know,
Amen.
31 years old, I was able to convince the court to send the case back down for a second trial, and the case went back down. So it gets a little weird at this time. This was back around April, May of 2023, and we tried to intervene in the case again at the Superior Court, the trial court, once it was sent back down. So we tried to file an amicus brief. And very unfortunately, Kerry Lake's attorneys objected to that filing, and they didn't include my argument in the trial. And because of that, Carrie Lake is now not the governor of Arizona. 6 months after that, six months later, in September of 2023, there was another lawsuit that had been filed in April of 2023 up in Yavapai County, Arizona, where other attorneys representing the Arizona Free Enterprise Club filed a action for declaratory and injunctive relief, alleging that the registration record is limited to documents that are signed by voters when they are registering or re-registering to vote. At the trial, it came out that Maricopa County included hundreds of thousands of mail-in ballot affidavit signatures in the registration record unlawfully. And those are not part of that document because in Arizona, when you register to vote, you have to provide what's called documented proof of citizenship. You have to actually establish that you are a U.S. citizen. It's a very unique state. Most states don't have this requirement. Mm-mm. But if you want to register or re-register to vote, you have to provide that documented proof of citizenship. And we found out during Carrie Lake's trial that Maricopa County took all of these vote-by-mail affidavit signatures where you don't provide an ID when you submit it. You basically just sign the affidavit, you put it in the mail and send it in. And they took those. They took 758,000 of those from the primary election in 2022. And they put them in their definition of the registration record. So they basically expanded the category unlawfully of what a registration record is. And then they exclusively compared the signatures coming in for review from these early ballot affidavit envelopes to those unlawful signatures. And they approved hundreds of thousands of them in a matter of seconds. So the whole election is void. And we are actually still litigating this issue. So I have another case now that has been pending since last year around December and September. These are two cases that have been combined. One of my clients is Abraham Hamadeh, who was the candidate for the Attorney General's office back in the 2022 general election. And we have a very big hearing on this issue coming up on October 24th at 9 a.m. in the Court of Appeals. So if we win this hearing, we actually will get a chance to try the case for Abe to see if he is the lawful AG in Arizona. And I feel very confidently that we will succeed and actually kick out Chris Mays from her office as AG.
Wow. That would be the most incredible thing ever, because the American people are watching, and I'll just say people not truly versed to the extent, obviously, of you are like, how long are we going to have to wait? How long do these cases need to be, right? And they have all these questions all the time. And I'm like, literally, the tie-up in this justice system, this two-tier justice system, has created what I would say another year on top of a year continuously, and for everyone to kind of look back. Like, so I know, like, having worked with True the Vote, so I did radio for Greg Phillips, right, on Onward. And we had a couple conversations, just like not directly, but through everyone that was working this project, about where to go with election results and who would be working them and what we could do. And I ran across this individual who I interviewed at the Reawaken Tour from my area, which blew me away. Okay. And it's going to lead me to my next question about your election. He blows me away and says, Wayne County isn't the most corrupt county. I'm like, oh, no. I'm in Wayne County, just way down south in Wayne County, right? And it's corrupt. He's like, well, what I'm trying to tell you is Washtenaw County is your most corrupt county. And I'm like, okay, so tell me why. And he's like, here's my evidence. So we had turned this all over, obviously, to True the Vote. This man had all this evidence of all these ballots that were stacked going to the college town right outside of Ann Arbor. And they were being stored inside of trailer parks that were kind of shut down, but illegals were living in it, I guess. So they were filling out the ballots, right? And they had all been mailed there and been stored there. And then he found an apartment complex. And this is coming out of Washtenaw, Michigan. So I talked to someone later who calls Maricopa County Maricorruption County. Okay. So I'm laughing about that term. And I'm like, tell me more, you know? So we're comparing these cases. And I'm like, so you have judges that actually know the corruption is in their face, like the evidence, and they're still sitting bench. So where are you at today with election and what's going and what's coming versus what you're handling still from your 2022? What's going on in Arizona now? Because I know in Michigan, I'll just say those cases are being investigated, you know, so that's a good thing to know. However, we don't really have the constitutional attorneys in place that we need. We have one that's really good with a team. Other than that, not so much. And you have a great team, it sounds like. So where are you at? Where is it going to go now? What's up and coming?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm obviously preparing for the upcoming election. I've been reviewing all of the different materials from the election procedures manual to Maricopa County's elections plan, looking for different areas that the county might be trying to exploit to unlawfully tabulate ballots here in Arizona. And we're prepared to file these lawsuits. We're very much, you know, apprised of the situation. We know what they must do to comply with the law. Arizona is a very unique state with respect to elections. We actually, in our constitution, because it was the 48th constitution adopted and ratified here in the United States, we have specific provisions that protect voters, unlike any other constitution across the nation. So in Arizona, every election must be decided based upon the highest number of legal votes. That's expressly within the Arizona Constitution. It's a fundamental right conferred to voters. We have the right to registration and other laws that are intended to secure the purity of our elections. And that's exactly what ARS 16550A is. So going back to the signature verification requirement for vote by mail affidavits, the courts in these cases that have been decided, the one from Yuma County in particular, explains that this law, because it is a registration law, it requires the voters to be registered in a particular way when you're doing signature verification and use the proper criteria for that process. That law is what's called a non-technical law. I know that you've had Michelle Swinnick on in the past. She's talked about this quite a bit. But a non-technical law is any law that's passed by the Arizona legislature with respect to elections that furthers or advances the rights secured by the Arizona Constitution. So if it's a registration law, if it's a law that pertains to how votes are supposed to be legally cast, those are non-technical laws. They're more than just a technicality. It's not something that can be disregarded or augmented by the county recorder or the elections directors throughout Arizona. And when you violate those laws in sufficient numbers, that's what we're taking. That's Abe's case in general. He lost by 280 votes. We have hundreds of thousands of votes here that were unlawfully counted. These are illegal ballots that were tabulated. That means that the election must be set aside as a matter of law. And we're asking the court to void 1.56 million votes from Maricopa County for the attorney general's race and just count the votes from other counties throughout Arizona, because Maricopa County is the only one throughout the entire state that conducts elections illegally with respect to the way they do signature verification. So the difference between Maricopa County and counties like Yavapai County, counties like Cochise County, is that Maricopa County has their own signature verification software they adopted and they created on their own. So every other county throughout Arizona besides Pima County and Maricopa County use what's called the AVID system. That's the Arizona Voter Information Database system that they use for signature verification. Okay. And when you're sitting down at a computer as a signature verifier in these counties outside of Maricopa and Pima, on the screen, you see every single signature that's within the voter's registration record. Every time a voter has signed a registration or a re-registration document, meaning they provided proof of citizenship and they put a signature on something and gave it to the county recorder, they can see all of those signatures at the same time when they're conducting signature review. But in Maricopa County, this software that they created only displays the most recent historical signature that was updated to the voter's registration record, whether or not that signature is from a lawful registration record, meaning you signed it and you showed your ID and you prove that you are a U.S. citizen. And so if you want to see any other signature to review as a signature reviewer, you actually have to scroll down on the screen. And what we learned at Kerry Lake's trial is that they accepted, meaning they did signature comparisons for hundreds of thousands of ballots in a matter of seconds, meaning it was physically impossible for the signature reviewers in Maricopa County to scroll down and actually look at valid signatures. So they basically just used the most recent historical signature, meaning 785,000 signatures from the primary election were uploaded as the most recent historical signatures into their database. And they compared hundreds of thousands of those against those specific exemplars without reviewing anything that was lawfully a registration record signature. I know this is a bit complicated, but
it's mind blowing too. I'm just mind blowing that it's so in our face how this works, like totally ignored. Like we don't matter. Like nobody's vote, nobody's signature just doesn't exist. And I've been doing this a long time. So I'm still sitting here taking in this information. Keep going though, because I'm into like learning about this. Like, you know, our knowledge is our power. So I can take everything I'm learning today and keep going with it, right?
That's right. And that's the unique thing about these types of cases. I mean, I'm not alleging fraud. I'm not alleging that any specific number of voters fraudulently signed documents who weren't registered to vote.
Right.
What I'm alleging is that the way they tabulated votes in Maricopa County was a misapplication of the law. And it was very intentional. And we didn't learn about this specific computer software, the difference between what Maricopa County was doing and what other counties were doing until 6 months after the election. And basically, the arguments that we're facing in Abe Hamadeh's case are that we sat on our hands too long and we only have one remedy provided for under Arizona law, which is the election contest statute. If you want to challenge an election in Arizona, there is a statute, it's ARS 16673. And it provides that within 5 days of the canvass, and those are 5 days generally, not just business days, you have to file your election challenge. Mm-hmm. But what happens when the county covers up the way that they illegally tabulated votes until half a year after the election, which is the case here? And our argument is that there are other ways to challenge elections in Arizona outside of that strict statutory deadline. In fact, the statute, the constitutional rights that are conferred to Arizona voters, the right to have the person elected having received the highest number of legal votes, are explicitly violated when you hold the citizens to a strict 5-day window and they learn about information that invalidates the election after that fact. So it's a very interesting lawsuit. This is something that hasn't been done before. Most of my lawsuits are that way. I'm very blessed in that I have ADHD, and it means that I lose my car keys on a regular basis. But I also come up with very unique and different approaches to tackling these complex legal issues. And that's exactly what we're doing here in these election cases in Arizona.
Wow. Well, thank you, Jesus, that you have ADHD, because we would be in a bad place if your mind didn't function the way that it does. And it's pretty common in my family. Sometimes I think I should be evaluated for it. I'm like, what did I do with my piece here? I don't know what happened, but I know what I'm going at, right?
I totally understand.
Yeah. So, wow. So up and coming for you with the 2024 election. What is this looking like in Arizona? Because this is going to be interesting. What is your Arizona take on where you're headed now?
Like, so obviously, we're exploring all options for my current clients to make sure the election is on the upright. If there are any other people out there that are interested in hiring my firm for election litigation to challenge the results, we're for hire. You can go to heathlaw.com and you can hire us there. But yeah, we're very excited to litigate these issues. I blocked off the entire month of November and December to actually take on these challenges because that's what it's going to take. So I have a number of attorneys that work for me and work with me, and we're ready to litigate.
All right. Well, I'm going to add this to the ticker here. Need a litigation. Just speak for people who watch this later that aren't live, right? They quite possibly could.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So tell me more why I type.
Okay. Well, I think I'd like to talk about another few cases that we've also filed on behalf of people here in Arizona. So one of the areas that I'm focusing now on is the COVID-19 protocols in hospitals here. So I've actually sued the Mayo Clinic. I've sued Banner Health. I've sued Honor Health, which are the three biggest medical providers here in the state. On behalf of individuals that have lost loved ones due to the mistreatment they received during the COVID-19 pandemic. So one of the cases that we are taking on is against the Mayo Clinic, and that case involves an individual who had basically mild symptoms for COVID-19, tested positive with a PCR test, was brought into the hospital, was starved, was mistreated by the staff for a number of days, and then he was basically killed because they gave him 16 doses of morphine in one day on his last day of life for no apparent reason. So we are litigating that issue. We have another case as well on behalf of an individual who lost her husband at Banner Health. Very similar circumstances, brought in, starved, not provided adequate treatment, not provided even a face cloth to, you know, wipe the dirt off of his face, left alone for hours without any assistance. And he ended up passing away after a few weeks in their facility. His wife was unable to actually see him. And they very much mistreated him while he was there. So we're filing these lawsuits on behalf of individuals that lost loved ones. And it's a very interesting area of law. We're trying to do all we can to avoid the PrEP Act, which is a grant of immunity to basically anyone who was involved for COVID treatment, who provided different types of treatments that are considered covered countermeasures, meaning they are within the ambit of the PrEP Act. They provide some sort of purported benefit to the individual receiving it, and there are no alternative treatments available. That's the standard there. So we're trying to avoid that. We're litigating those issues, and we're very optimistic about those cases as well, and we're hopeful that we'll be able to actually provide some benefit to the people there that were injured.
Oh, God bless you. There are so many vax injury cases right now. Mm-hmm. I'm actually living through a little bit of it in my family as well. I have a niece who's vaccinated who didn't want to really listen to the rest of us kind of saying, no, you don't have to do this. You know, we can definitely work through this. And if you are being required, we can definitely attempt to get you the waivers that you need. Right. And let us help. Well, that didn't go well. And she was vaccinated and she's a few years younger than, or actually just like a year younger than me. And later ends up with acute myeloid leukemia. And it was to the degree of someone who has Down syndrome as a child. She does not have Down syndrome. We were able to verify that she, due to a loss in the family and a other DNA test that was done, that she had no cells for Down syndrome 10 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. So we went ahead and had her tested again. So basically a genetic testing, right? Comes back that she has 1-2% Down syndrome now. Mm-hmm. How do you get Down syndrome when you're in your 40s?
It's your chromosomes. It's so interesting.
Yeah. So it was like a mRNA kind of what I would say manipulation of the DNA. And now she is not well. She had to receive a, what's it called? Like a bone. It's like a bone marrow transplant, right? So that's been really difficult. And yeah, it's really difficult. It's my sister's daughter. So, you know, watching it in your own family, like you become a statistic, right? Many stories across the land. And yesterday, the same thing with this Alexis, who I don't know if you saw her all over. She was on my friend's show, The Big Mig, last night. Mm-hmm. And I was literally just bawling for this poor girl and the way she was being treated prior to opening up her story. And she's doing this from the ICU, you right. know? And so now there's an advocate that stepped in.
Nurse Angela is a good friend of mine, so I'm very glad that she's in good hands.
Amen for her. I was bawling watching, like, this is an incredible thing. She's so strong to do this at this time, you know. And what you're doing is the work of – it's really a mission from God that he has set you on. And I just love watching this walk because we all have a part somewhere, and this seems to be something that – you know, God has stepped in and really said, all right, Ryan, I have a job for you, you know, and it's beautiful to watch from afar. I know that it's difficult. I know that it's got to be hard on your family, and God bless you for doing everything Thank that you. You're doing. Yeah. Scary Thanks. Times. Do you have any advice for anyone if they need to, if they have a vax injury right now? What would be like good advice for them in their state to start a process of saying, hey, man, I need to get an attorney and move forth with some kind of action. I've been injured by this vaccination.
I would say to do two things. One would be to make sure you're following Children's Health Defense and you're actually paying attention to them. Follow them on social media, go to their website, get information there. And then the other person that I would say to pay close attention to is Aaron Seary. He's another attorney out of Arizona here that's been litigating these vax injury cases across the country. And he is one of the only brave individuals out there that is really challenging the PREP Act on constitutional grounds, which is very difficult to do. So I believe he has a case now that's in the Fifth Circuit, and he is litigating that issue. So everyone should be praying for him for success for his cases. Those cases are extremely expensive. It's not something that I have the funds to actually litigate myself. I'd be happy to do it. I've got some ideas on how to do it. But very unfortunately, I just don't have the resources to take on those types of cases. You know, when I started the Gavel Project, we did it on a hope and a prayer. We actually liquidated one of our family vehicles. I had my own truck, and my wife had a vehicle as well. And we ended up litigating my truck so that we could, liquidating my truck, not litigating it.
Fine.
Liquidating the vehicle so that we could put seed money together to, fund the Gavel Project. And we've been very blessed since starting the nonprofit organization to have an outpouring of support financially, which is absolutely necessary. I mean, the types of cases we take on are very expensive. Any lawsuit's expensive. We have three cases right now that we're litigating in California on behalf of kids. Again, one kid was stuck in a closet, one little girl, fifth grader, for simply wanting to go to school unvaccinated. And they quarantined her because she had come into close contact, whatever the hell that means, with someone who apparently tested positive for COVID-19. And this little girl was alienated, belittled, made fun of. She was put through hell. And we're doing all that we can to make sure that we hold the individuals who did that to her personally accountable. And that's because you as an individual, and people don't seem to realize the way that, constitutional litigation works.
Yeah.
The Constitution sets the minimum bar for what the government can do. Anything beyond that is excessive, and it violates your constitutional rights. If they step over that line, if they take an action that exceeds what the Constitution says the government can do, you can file a lawsuit under Title 42, Section 1983 of the U.S. Code. That's the Civil Rights Act of 1871. It's called the Ku Klux Klan Act for a reason, and it allows you to file lawsuits against people who act under color and authority of state law to violate your civil rights. And so that's what we're doing. We're trying to sue these people personally, to hold them personally accountable for the actions they took for violating the constitutional rights of our clients, to send a message to others. It's not about these cases in particular. Obviously, I'm doing all that I can to represent the interests of these people. But the purpose of the Gavel Project has always been to set precedent and show folks in similar situations in the future that you're not going to walk away scot-free if you decide to forcibly put a face diaper on a child for 8 hours a day while they're in school as a conditioned precedent of simply getting an education, which is absolutely absurd. And so that's what we're doing. We're trying to make sure that our nation doesn't fall into a civil war, which I believe is just around the corner. If we don't have President Trump elected, I think that there will be a civil war. Yeah. And we need to make sure that we fight while we can across the board in the court systems, that we don't have to actually resort to violence. I don't want to see that. I've studied history close enough to know that violence is not the answer when you have means that are civil to resolve disputes between people. And so that's what we're doing. We're trying to hold these people accountable. The motto of the Gavel Project is better a gavel than a gun, because I'm a much better lawyer than I am a shot.
I love that. I know, my husband said, well, who's on your show today? So I'm telling him that you do the Gavel Project. He's like, yeah, that's right. Slap that gavel down. You know, like, he was all excited about the name of it even. And I was like, yeah, it's you know, an amazing organization, nonprofit organization. Yeah, truly, truly. So what exactly is ESG? I know you're versed on this, and I would like to learn a little bit about that while you're here. I'm not aware.
Yeah, ESG it's an acronym, and it basically goes hand in hand with the way that corporations and organizations across the country qualify for certain funding benefits on the different stock exchanges in New York and elsewhere. And what it stands for is environmental, social, and governance. It basically is a way to implement a social credit score through corporations, because we don't have we don't live in a communist or socialist system. The way to control the actions of individuals and make sure that they are socially abiding by the standards that the overlords want to set on our lives is to take control of corporations across the country. And the way you do that is you implement ESG requirements in order to qualify for funding. So if you want to, let's say, issue an IPO, an initial public offering, as a private organization going public, and you want to qualify for people to buy stocks in your company, a lot of times you have to hit certain ESG standards that are set by the stock exchanges, by different government organizations, the Securities and Exchange Commission, for example. And you have to show that you are sufficiently woke, in essence. And if you don't have these policies in place, if you don't have certain hiring criteria, if you don't have a diverse, you know, employee base, then you don't qualify for those types of funds. And that's basically how they control the lives of citizens through corporations in the United States. We actually have a very interesting lawsuit that I filed in May of this year. I represent a person named Chad DeVries, who is up in Yavapai County, Arizona. He lives in Prescott. He's the number one real estate agent in the area. And he was punished by the Arizona Association of Realtors because he was posting memes on his private social media accounts. And they were claiming that violated the code of ethics for the Arizona Association of Realtors. But it in no way violated the code of ethics. The code of ethics is a governing document that was adopted by the Arizona Association of Realtors. It's written by the National Association of Realtors. So this is going on across the country. And it enumerates certain things that you have to abide by as a individual realtor, as a member of that private organization. Mm-hmm. And what it says, this is the one in question, the code of ethic in question is number 10. And what number 10 says is that in your professional services and in your employment practices, you cannot discriminate against individuals based on race, ethnicity, national origin, sex, gender identity. Those are the things that it says. What it doesn't say is that the organization gets to govern your private life. It gets to control what speech you state in your private capacity as a citizen in your social media accounts. And regardless of that, they went through this whole ethical proceeding with him. They punished him. They fined him $1,000. They're threatening to take away his access to the multiple listing service, which means that he couldn't do his job anymore simply because he was expressing a viewpoint that was disagreeable to the organization. So that's an ESG issue as well. It's a diversity, equity, and inclusion issue within the organization. So we're litigating that. We're suing for breach of contract. We're suing for tortious interference with contract. We're actually naming the individuals who filed these bogus ethics complaints against my client. Mm-hmm. And we're hoping to hold them accountable. And again, the purpose here is to make sure that in the future, this doesn't happen to other folks. My client is incredibly brave. He has the resources to fund the lawsuit, and he's doing it. And we're actually trying to hold these people accountable.
Oh, amen. It is crazy to me how now we Americans or conservatives or, you know, someone who's solid, a solid constitutionalist are under fire. We're the ones getting segregated and getting social credit scores that are, you know, unacceptable, in my opinion. So how in the heck did we not know this was occurring prior to the 2020 election? Because it truly was. And then, you know, I started looking around through some interviews the other day, and one of the guys I had on, it's been a good year and a half, 2 years ago. It was the strangest interview. it was so strange. I agreed to have him on. He was in a movie. And I thought, sure, we'll get you on. He was transgender. But when he got here, he didn't want to be a man anymore because of what had happened to him. So then I was going to call him a she, but because that's his biological birth, right? And he said no, that he was an illusion. And I said, okay. Well, he kind of gets really like violent on screen. It was the strangest interview, like I said, but I could understand why. He had a lot of issues, not just with social credit scores and stuff prior to that. Now that he was like all the rage, he was talking against transgender. Mm-hmm. And reason being is he had multiple infection after infection and graphenes and all these things done to this poor man at a young age, well, woman at a younger age, where psychologists kind of made him think he, through therapy, was, you know, living in a body that wasn't him. So he ends up doing the procedures that ruined him, and literally to the point of, like, you know, hair growing on the inside of his organs because of the way that these medical procedures were that could have killed him multiple times. So he was very upset. So I agree to discuss these things. And I know right now, I guess we should get into it today, definitely before we go and highlight the Gavel Project today, about where we're at in America with transgender issues legally. So I'm trying to figure out how they ended up with more legal rights than most Americans. How did this happen, and what stemmed this? You know, I mean, I'm aware, but we should tell the audience, right? Like, it obviously matters who our administration is. You know, that's number one. You know, that the presidency matters. So what's it like out there in Arizona with the transgender issues? And do you have anything that's being litigated right now for any transgender people that would be significant to our audience today?
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes wonder late at night how it is that we got in a position where school teachers are going around lying to children about how they can change sex. And somehow, you know, magically, apparently, just become a man based on declaring it if you're a girl, or vice versa. It's quite absurd. In my view, this is very similar to the COVID-19 mandates that we all suffered through. The idea is to demoralize the youth, to teach them lies about reality, to make it so they can't understand what is true and what is wrong. I know Yuri Bezmenov, who was a former KGB agent, came over in the 1980s and spoke very in detail about the idea of ideological subversion. If you're not familiar with that, I very much encourage the audience, if you've never heard of Yuri Bezmenov, to go on YouTube, search for Yuri Bezmenov, look up the speeches that he gave back in the 1980s about the concept of ideological subversion, which is a KGB initiative that was adopted during the Cold War to demoralize the country and basically make it so that the nation falls apart from within. And that's exactly what happened during COVID. That's exactly what's happening with this transgender issue. They're trying to capture the minds of young people to make it so they can't discern right from wrong. They can't discern truth from fiction, and make it so they can't make informed decisions in their lives to actually be productive members of society.
Right.
Now, with respect to litigation on this issue, I have drafted a lawsuit. I drafted it a long time ago, and I've been waiting for an angel donor to come in and actually help with this. We have plaintiffs lined up. This is against Peoria Unified School District here in Arizona. And the lawsuit is challenging the restroom policy on the basis of the Establishment Clause of the United States Constitution. Now, let's take a big picture look of how this works, right? So one of the protections of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, we also have state constitutional provisions that mirror this as well. So it's not just a federal claim, it's also a state constitutional claim. But one of the provisions is that the government cannot establish a religion or force people to participate in religious acts. And that's exactly what gender ideology is. When you are telling a young girl or a young boy that they can, without any evidence, somehow change the most fundamental aspect of themselves, and you are telling young male students they can use female facilities, you are forcing girls to participate in a religious practice. Now, the reason that gender ideology is a religion stems back to the Vietnam War. There was a case that came through the United States Supreme Court called Seeger, and there was a subsequent case called Welsh. And what these cases concerned was whether someone who was a conscientious objector to military service could get out of combat duty, even though they didn't ascribe to a traditional religion. So the question for the court was, what is a religion in the constitutional sense? What does that mean? What does it mean to be religious? And these individuals, to give some further background, actually stated they did not believe that the norms that govern their lives were religious. They basically explained, I have all of these internal propositions that I live my life by. I have these governing principles that are so profound to me that I cannot violate them. I cannot take another man's life as a means to an end. That was basically the crux of what they were saying. It is foundational to my being that if I do this, I could not live with myself. And the court found in that case that even though these people weren't religious per se, they did have religious beliefs, because a religion in the eyes of the law is a set of norms that a person adopts that governs their life. That is the person's ultimate concern. It governs all aspects of their life. They live their life by a certain code. And that's exactly what we have here with gender ideology, is a set of norms that is ascribed to by its adherents that governs all aspects of their life. If you step outside of line, in the same way that if you become a heretic by going in the Christian faith and absconding from the Christian faith, you become a heretic, you denounce God. If you denounce gender ideology as a former practitioner, you are a heretic, you are a transphobe. You never were a transgender individual. You never believed in transgender ideology. It's a dogmatic belief system. I mean, I don't mean to call Christianity a dogmatic belief system, but by definition it is. I don't mean to be that, to give any negative connotation to that. But what is faith? Faith is belief without evidence. It is taking a leap of faith across the line, even though you don't have a specific kernel of evidence to prove that Jesus Christ is the Son of God resurrected. We still believe that.
Right.
We still ascribe to that belief. And the same thing is true with gender ideology. They don't have the scientific basis to conclude that you can become a man or you can become a woman, but they take a leap of faith in the same way. And so this lawsuit claims that by forcing girls to use the restroom facilities with members of the opposite sex, you are forcing those girls to support the religious principle of those people that are using the restroom. And it's a very clear lawsuit. This case was recently upheld in a lawsuit out of Washington, this whole concept. If you may have heard of this football coach who was taking a knee on the 50-yard line, you know, during football games and praying, and he had students joining him. He wasn't asking them to do that. And the court says that you can, you know, practice your religion as a public school teacher. You can, pray in class. Mm-hmm. You can do these things, but you can't force others to participate in that practice. And that's exactly what gender ideology is doing here. These teachers, by forcing students to use the facilities with members of the opposite sex, are forcing those kids to ascribe to a religion. They're supporting that religion. And so it's a very clear-cut lawsuit. It could change the entire landscape for girls across the nation. I'm a father of two beautiful little girls. I don't want them to have to worry about going into the bathroom at school and having to have a male student in there. Males across the board, members of the male sex, commit something like 90% of violent crimes in this country. Yeah. Why would I put my daughter in a situation where it's even possible that they might be raped or they might be assaulted in a bathroom? And that's exactly what the Establishment Clause was intended to protect against. And that's why we're going to be hopefully filing that lawsuit here in the near future. It's already been drafted. I could file it tomorrow if someone came in with the funds. So if you're interested in actually helping with that, you can go to thegavelproject.com. You can go to heathlaw.com. You can contact me there, and I'd be happy to speak with you.
Amazing, because this is what we're going to need, especially like when I've listened to even Elon Musk discuss the woke mind virus, you know. And we had a situation here in a conservative town that they opened up a unisex bathroom in the middle school and the high school. And yes, we raged. Okay, my husband raged. That's when we realized, school board, you need 500 people to run. You need to get all conservatives to run. You need to step in and, the local action and, run for mayor and win, right? Okay. So you got to do things to, like, really get involved to end the woke mind virus in your area. And I'm going to say somebody really big is coming your way who has that kind of money. Boy, if I won tomorrow, I would be calling you. I would be like, hey, I just hit the Powerball. How much do you need? Because we got to do this. And I know that there's people out there that are waiting to fund these things, and we just need to get the information to them. And we are on X today. So if anybody is on there, please tag Elon Musk and let him know. We might need
a donor.
Yes. Well, I would love to have you talk to him and let him know that we have an attorney today on the show that would love to discuss helping end the woke mind virus, which is what he set out to do. That is why he is so involved. And, you know, he lost his son to the woke mind virus. So, you know, when you go through stuff like that, you start to see the world for what it is, you know? And then here comes people, little angels like yourself, walking the earth that can comprehend enough information to get it done. And that's what's really, you know, becoming important to America now, is that our knowledge is our power and we must use it,
right?
You know, so everybody's got a window and we got to act on it. You are quite amazing. Can I just tell you that? I am like over the top that I was able to get with you today.
Well, glory to God. That's I don't take credit for anything that I've done. It is all His glory. And I'm just here to serve. And I really do want to help protect the future for our kids, because nothing is more important as a father. I have a hard time with how many people are just sitting by on the sidelines watching and hoping that someone else does the fight for them. It's like, at some point you either need to put up or shut up. You can't complain about our society and not do anything about it. It doesn't make sense to me. So I know not everyone has the capacity to step out onto the ledge and actually, you know, declare war on folks, peaceful war. I'm not declaring war, peaceful action, but that is what it's going to take. It's going to take folks going out and supporting individuals like myself who are willing to get into the fight.
Amen. I want to get everybody over to thegavelproject.com today. You can also go to Heath Waugh and, you know, show your support there if you can't step up and get involved at the level that would require not just a lot of funding and knowledge, but licensing. So, you know, step up and show your support there. Not here on PHP today, but please take that over to Mr. Heath, and I would appreciate that. So, if there's anything else you want to say before we go today, we're going to leave on a clip from the Flynn movie. So before we do that, I just wanted to make sure that you have all your information out and that you got a wrap. Is there anything else?
Just to, you know, briefly conclude, the gifts to the Gavel Project are tax deductible. So you can actually opt to give your tax dollars to a nonprofit organization such as the Gavel Project. Instead of giving your money to Uncle Sam to wage a war against you, I encourage you to go to thegavelproject.com. You can make a gift right there on the website. And again, I no one besides the attorneys that are actually working on the cases that we are hiring. I'm not licensed in California. So those attorneys are the ones that are getting paid. I'm not getting paid from the Gavel Project. I don't take a cent from the organization. This is all charity work for me. So we are doing our best to push back against the woke mind virus, and that's exactly what we intend to do. So please consider making a donation today.
Oh, God bless you, Ryan. If there's anything here at PHP we can ever do for you, please reach out. I would love to have you back sometime after your, you know, next case is litigated, and keep us updated, and we'll be showing our support as well at thegavelproject.com, you guys. So thank you for carving time out for us today, and the American people watching, and our Scottish people watching, and London, and all across the land, and hello, India. I appreciate you too. Been getting a lot of messages. It's amazing to me from India. Like, they're so fascinated with what's going on. They're like, please save America so everything here gets better. Who knew? I didn't even know India cared. So thank you, India. We appreciate you. And I just want to say, Ryan's a very valuable person in our planet right now. And I would appreciate everyone also saying prayers for him on his mission, and show your support if you can. So we appreciate you guys. So go to thegavelproject.com to show your support, y'all. God bless y'all. God bless POTUS 45 and God bless America. We're going to go into a clip. I'm Just Jody from the Patriots Helping Patriots Network and the Java with Just Jody show. I'll catch you all soon.
Thank you, Jody.
Former National Security Advisor, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, pleading guilty today for lying to the FBI.
Flynn knew exactly how the system worked. He knew exactly what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding. They had to get rid of Flynn.
There was a moment where I just felt like I was drowning. And so I'm in there with these other political appointees. They're all supposed to go in there and tell what they believe to be the truth. What they did was they took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. I was like, I'm not changing it.
He was, by definition, the most dangerous possible person for Donald Trump to hire.
President Obama said, but I do have one specific recommendation. Stay away from Michael Flynn. He's bad news.
Over time, instead of being pounded down below the surface of the ocean, we started to fight. I'm now above the surface.